Hello and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op.
Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM. That's 103.2 FM up there in Preston and Radio Verulam in St Albans.
There was something mystical and kind of magical and uplifting about the crop circles.
Yes, you can find out all about crop circles later on in the show.
Amíg csak a szomszédok lettek volna, hát ott feküdtél mellettem. Letagadod, letagad!
Emese Bavanyecny Szolma on Hungarian Radio is here in the studio to tell us more. Malcolm Grieve reads Chapter 10 from Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Rosemary Dunn, poet, is here in the studio, and so too is Tim Burrows to play us a tune.
Our guest in the studio is Malcolm Beecham from the Company of Chivalry. But first, let's play us a track now. It's called Love Is All Around by Wet, 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 and it's from the 1994 film Notting Hill. Reg Presley, who wrote the song, used the royalties from the hit single to research into the phenomena, and he outlined his findings in a book called Wild Things They Don't Tell Us, published in October 2002. We find out later from eyewitness accounts all about crop circles.
I'm Alec Mill.
And I'm Sophia Costa.
Yeah.
Our guest this week is Malcolm Beecham from the Company of Chivalry.
Hello there.
Hello, Malcolm. Can you tell me, what is the company all about?
Well, basically, the Company of Chivalry was formed way back in 1988, and it basically brings people who have a love of history to life. We meet most weekends throughout the summer period, and we try to recreate the medieval period from 1370 to 1390. And we try to give people a hands-on approach to play with the weapons, come and speak to our people, get involved in the activity which is actually happening on any particular day we do an event.
And why is there such interest in this medieval reenactment?
Well, within any reenactment, you can have any period you like. Obviously, we portray the medieval period because it was a period we all like as a group of about 60 people. We love that particular period. But there are various other periods. You know, you can go from the Stone Age right up to World War II. So whichever area you wish to devise your interest in, you can go in that. But the medieval period is very interesting, certainly from an English history point of view, because so many things happened. You know, we had battles with basically everybody on the planet, to be perfectly honest, particularly, you know, the French against the Scots and against the Welsh. So we try to portray and bring that life into a scene so people can see what went on.
And with the reenactment, is it the military side of it or is it everyday life that you deal with?
We do all of it. We do the medieval life of people, you know, from cooks to people making coins to a doctor on site. So we portray the living history camp all whilst we're on site. We also are a military camp, which I basically then portray all the soldiers for John of Gaunt. That's the household we follow. So again, we portray soldiers drilling, we're fighting, combat, we'll have full armoured knights, but also a social side. So it shows the social effects of the medieval period during the period as well. So we try to bring the whole period to life in one foul swoop, and we do various events throughout the year.
And the range of reenactors, are they from all walks of life?
Yes, they are. We have age groups from sort of a six-month-old baby up to 70-year-olds. They go across a span of doctors, solicitors, lorry drivers. And, you know, we welcome members from every walk of life, to be perfectly honest, because you need that mix. The beauty of what we all love is that we all love history and we all love the medieval period. And that's what brings us together most weekends for the summer period.
And you're based in Bristol, Weston-super-Mare, I believe.
That's right, yeah. Most of our memberships come from the Weston, Bristol area. But again, we take members from all over the country, so some people will travel from further afield as well.
Right, so do you occupy a castle when you go for a reenactment?
Yes, we do. We do a lot of events with Cadw, which is obviously the Welsh heritage, who looks after a lot of the Welsh castles. We're heavily involved with Caerphilly Castle, particularly in South Wales. We go to Scotland, but we also do an event in Italy as well. So we will travel anywhere, wherever there needs to be an event put on, and we will portray that period throughout wherever we end up going. So we try to bring the castles to life, because when there's nothing going on, they're beautiful buildings to look at, but there's nothing to actually see what's going on in them. So if we can bring them to life with fighting, with combat, with the fires, the cooking and the smells and the music from the period, people do enjoy and can actually see it in its true glory.
Mm-hmm. So the costumes and the equipment that you have, is this material that you make yourself?
Yes, basically all the costumes and the footwear, underclothing, chainmail, we tend to make all ourselves. We do use specialist companies for some of the weapons, particularly swords, and we use a specialist company to make our authentic tents, because whilst we're on site, we actually stay on site, so obviously we need somewhere to live, so everything else is then made within the group. So somebody who wants to make arrows would then do a trade by saying, I'll make you some arrows, but I'm also good at making some shoes. So there'd be some swaps so people can use each other's skills to try and portray what also happened in the period, because everything we make is we try to keep it as authentic as we can, from the stitching to the feathers we use on and all the clothing types we use.
Mm. So there must be a lot of research goes into this.
A lot of research. We're in London quite a lot, because a lot of certainly the clothing finds which we tend to use for research were obviously from the Thames, dug up because they managed to preserve themselves in the muds. So yeah, a lot of research. But again, history can change. If suddenly we're going along and somebody finds something, comes to us and say, we found some different history. So history can change. It's whatever they dig up is whatever they find. So we're always open to ideas from the public, because the public can have something we don't know. And that's what gives it the beauty, to be perfectly honest.
Mm-hmm. I've got a personal interest in history. Is it something that you're perhaps involved with a time team, maybe? Another time team on television?
Yes, we have worked with a time team on numerous occasions. I've researched. We have actually a medieval doctor, actually, within our group, is actually a real doctor in real life, and he has done lots of work with the time team crew. So, again, we also get involved with lots of films and extras as films. We actually do a lot of research for film companies as well, because a lot of the American film companies come over here to obviously make a lot of their medieval films. So we try to give them assistance and help and actually supply extras as well.
And funding, how do you fund the group?
Basically, the group is a non-for-profit group, so all individuals do it as a hobby. There's no payment for individuals to actually do this. It's purely their hobby. As a society, we will set a figure or a fee, and we will charge whoever we're supplying that to. Again, it's not huge amounts of money. It's really just to cover the cost of the society, insurance, vans, and some of the equipment. But most of the equipment, to be perfectly honest, is owned by individuals. So it can mount up to many thousands of pounds over time, the amount of money you spend on equipment, depending on what level you want to be within the society.
And health and safety must form a strong part of what you do, because there's a lot of activity with swords and weaponry.
Yeah, health and safety will always play a part in any modern life nowadays, and obviously we can never get away from that. But again, you've got to have a common sense approach. All of our soldiers, all the combat people, they're fully trained. Most of the winter period is spent around the Bristol area, up on the downs, basically trying to make sure that the weapons they're using, the swords, are actually training, but also training from an authentic point of view. So they would generally come into society at 7 or 8 years old, train for 4, 5, 6 years and gradually work their way up to the level which is competent on the battlefield. We also do get involved in other huge battles like the Battle of Tewkesbury, which is on in the 8th and 9th of July. There's 2,000 reenactors on the field, so training plays a major, major part. But we don't get many injuries, to be perfectly honest.
I understand you're involved in an American film that's coming out.
Yeah, there's a film which I think is due out at the end of June called Ironclad. It was filmed a couple of years ago. Now, basically, Ironclad is a reproduction of one of the great sieges during the medieval period, and basically where they used us as a society, we are very specialists in the use of medieval siege warfare, particularly when you look at the trebuchet. The trebuchet was actually used in the film, and we supplied not only the extras, but we also supplied the expertise in actually manufacturing and remaking a full-size trebuchet.
That is an enormous catapult, I believe.
It is enormous. It's what's known as the counterbalance trebuchet. So there's a huge basket of about 3 tons of stone, a long arm, a sling underneath, and it pulls round and then throws a ball to whatever object you used. The actual film was built on the Battle of Rochester, which was quite a battle during the period. Again, it's a very gruesome film, but it is out. It's been into the cinemas. It's out hopefully this week, and certainly go and have a see a copy. You would never identify any of us because, unfortunately, like all things, are makeup in the costumes are rather hairy people. So it's good to get involved with film companies because, you know, they do like our history in this country and they do like the expertise. So definitely well worth a watch.
Right. And if anyone's interested in joining your group, are you still looking for new members?
Yes, we're always looking for new members because, like we say, we welcome members from every age range. Again, you can log on to our website if anybody wants to. It's www.companyofchivalry.com. And on there you will see all the details about the company, what we do. There's photographs, everything we get up to, and make any inquiries through there, and we will certainly get back to people. And like we say, we welcome membership from any race, anybody, male, female, children. We welcome them all.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for coming on Dialect.
Okay, no, thank you for the opportunity. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Our next guest is Emesé Bamanyecny-Szolma from Hungary, who's a well-known radio presenter over there.
FM 95.4 Rádió 88 az életünk része, ez pedig a Café 88 az édesébredés. Szép reggelt kívánunk mindenkinek, 4 perc múlva lesz reggel 6 óra. A mikrofonnál...
Ez Szolma Emesé, eszembe jutott.
És Bálint K. Gergő, te drága.
Ó, te drága, hogy telt a hétvégéd?
Köszönöm szépen, nagyon gyorsan. Ja, rájöttem, hogy ilyenkor hétvégén én olyan sokat alszok, hogy az valami eszméletlen. Tehát ilyenkor pótolom be a heti koránkeléseket, és ilyen komolyan képes vagyok 10-12 órát is aludni. Na, mit szólsz?
Az hagyjál még, hogy horkolsz, hallottam múltkor a szomszédok élménybeszámolóját.
Mert ha még csak a szomszédok lettek volna, hát ott feküdtél mellettem. Letagadod, letagadsz!
Az a baj.
Welcome to the Dialect, Emesé.
Hello there, I'm very happy to be here.
Well, thank you. Tell me all about the program that you have on in Hungarian radio.
It was Radio 88, Radio 88 in Hungarian. I did the morning show with one of my colleagues from early morning, from 6 to 10. Every weekday, so we have to get up very early in the morning, 4 o'clock. So after we have to go to the studio and do the morning show.
What sort of show is it that you co-host it?
Yeah. It was I think it was a light show. It was a morning show. We talked about light political news, cultural news, connecting to the local communities and connecting to Szeged.
Szeged, that's a place in Hungary?
Yeah, that mm-hmm. is the name of the town where the radio is.
Mm-hmm. How many listeners do you have listening to your particular program or the radio station?
There is a survey connecting to the listeners twice in 1 year, and it says that the radio reaches 60,000 persons one day. It is very good, not just in Szeged, but in Hungary as well.
Mm-hmm. So the content is political. Do you have guests on with playing music?
Yeah, political, but I mean light political situation connecting to Szeged and cultural events, cultural programs, and it was light, not so hard.
And at a personal level, what is your background to radio? Journalism, maybe? Studies?
Yeah, I learned media journalism and journalism in the University of Szeged, so I have a bachelor degree as well.
And do you actually produce any shows as well as co-hosting them?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. And we organized some events, I mean music, cultural events as well. And I worked as a presenter in these events.
And if anyone wants to get in to listen live on the internet, can they do so? Is there a website?
Yeah, of course, there is a website as well, www.radio88.hu.
Well, thank you very much, Emesé.
Thank you.
Time now for Chapter 10 of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson and narrated by Malcolm Grieve. Treasure Island is an adventure story narrating the tale of pirates and buried gold. First published in May 1883, it was originally serialised by the children's magazine Young Folks between 1881 and 1882, under the title Treasure Island or the Making of the Hispaniola, and the pseudonym Captain George North. The novel is divided into 6 parts and 34 chapters. Jim Hawkins is the narrator for the majority of the book, except for chapters 16 to 18, which are narrated by Dr. Livesey. It is one of the most frequently dramatised novels.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 2, The Ship's Cook. Chapter 10, The Voyage. All that night we were in a great bustle getting things stowed in their place and boatfuls of the Squire's friends, Mr. Blandley and the like, coming off to wish him a good voyage and a safe return. We never had a night at the Admiral Benbow when I had half the work, and I was dog-tired when a little before dawn the boatswain sounded his pipe and the crew began to man the capstan bars. I might have been twice as weary, yet I would not have left the deck. All was so new and interesting to me. The brief commands, the shrill note of the whistle, the men bustling to their places in the glimmer of the ship's lanterns.
"Now, barbecue, sip us a stave,"
cried one voice.
"The old one,"
cried another.
"Aye, aye, mates,"
said Long John, who was standing by with his crutch under his arm, and at once broke out into the air in the words I knew so well.
15 men on a dead man's chest.
And then the whole crew bore chorus.
Yo, ho, ho, and a bottle of rum.
And at the third ho drove the bars before them with a will. Even at that exciting moment, it carried me back to the old Admiral Benbow in a second, and I seemed to hear the voice of the captain piping in the chorus. But soon the anchor was short up. Soon it was hanging dripping at the bows. Soon the sails began to draw and the land and shipping to flit by on either side. And before I could lie down to snatch an hour of slumber, the Hispaniola had begun her voyage to the Isle of Treasure. I'm not going to relate that voyage in detail. It was fairly prosperous. The ship proved to be a good ship. The crew were capable seamen and the captain thoroughly understood his business. But before we came the length of Treasure Island, two or three things had happened which require to be known. Mr. Arrow, first of all, turned out even worse than the captain had feared. He had no command among the men, and people did what they pleased with him. But that was by no means the worst of it, for after a day or two at sea, he began to appear on deck with hazy eye, red cheeks, stuttering tongue, and other marks of drunkenness. Time after time he was ordered below in disgrace. Sometimes he fell and cut himself. Sometimes he lay all day long in his little bunk at one side of the companion. Sometimes for a day or two he would be almost sober and attend to his work at least passably. In the meantime we could never make out where he got the drink. That was the ship's mystery. Watch him as we pleased, we could do nothing to solve it. And when we asked him to his face, he would only laugh if he were drunk. And if he was sober, deny solemnly that he'd ever tasted anything but water. He was not only useless as an officer and a bad influence amongst the men, but it was plain that at this rate he must soon kill himself outright. So nobody was much surprised, nor very sorry, when one dark night with a head sea, he disappeared entirely and was seen no more.
"Overboard," said the captain. "Well, gentlemen, that saves the trouble of putting him in irons."
But there we were without a mate, and it was necessary, of course, to advance one of the men. The boatswain, Job Anderson, was the likeliest man aboard, and though he kept his old title, he served in a way as mate. Mr. Trelawney had followed the sea, and his knowledge made him very useful, for he often took a watch himself in easy weather. And the coxswain, Israel Hands, was a careful, wily old experienced seaman, who could be trusted at a pinch with almost anything. He was a great confidant of Long John Silver, and so the mention of his name leads me on to speak of our ship's cook, Barbecue, as the men called him. Aboard ship he carried his crutch by a lanyard around his neck to have both hands as free as possible. It was something to see him wedge the foot of the crutch against a bulkhead and propped against it, yielding to every movement of the ship, get on with his cooking like someone safe ashore. Still more strange was it to see him in the heaviest of weather cross the deck. He had a line or two rigged up to help him across the widest spaces. Long John's earrings, they were called. And he would hand himself from one place to another, now using the crutch, now trailing it alongside by the lanyard, as quickly as another man could walk. Yet some of the men who'd sailed with him before expressed their pity to see him so reduced.
"He's no common man, Barbecue," said the coxswain to me. "He had good schooling in his young days, and can speak like a book when so minded. And brave. A lion's nothing alongside of Long John. I seen him grapple four, and knock their heads together. Him unarmed."
All the crew respected and even obeyed him. He had a way of talking to each, and doing everybody some particular service. To me he was unweariedly kind, and always glad to see me in the galley, which he kept as clean as a new pin, the dishes hanging up burnished, and his parrot in a cage in one corner.
"Come away, Hawkins," he would say. "Come and have a yarn with John. Nobody more welcome than yourself, my son. Sit you down, and hear the news. Here's Captain Flint. I calls my parrot Captain Flint, after the famous buccaneer. Here's Captain Flint, predicting success to our voyage. What's in you, Captain?"
And the parrot would say with great rapidity, "Pieces of eight, pieces of eight, pieces of eight," till he wondered that it was not out of breath, or till John threw his handkerchief over the cage.
"Now that bird," he would say, "is maybe 200 years old, Hawkins. He lives forever, mostly. And if anybody's seen more wickedness, it must be the devil himself. She sailed with England, the great Captain England, the pirate. She's been at Madagascar and at Malabar
and Suriname, and Providence, and Portobello. She was at the fishing up of the wrecked plate ships. It was there she learned pieces of eight. And little wonder, 350,000 of them, Hawkins. She was at the boarding of the Viceroy of the Indies out of Goa, she was. And to look at her, you would think she was a babby. But you smelt powder, didn't you, Cap'n?
Stand by to go about,
the parrot would scream. Ah, she's a handsome craft, she is, the cook would say, and give her sugar from his pocket. And then the bird would peck at the bars and swear straight on, passing belief for wickedness. There, John would add, you can't touch pitch and not be mucked, lad. Here's this poor old innocent bird of mine, swearing blue fire, and none the wiser, you may lay to that. She would swear the same, in a manner of speaking, before chaplain. And John would touch his forelock with a solemn way he had that made me think he was the best of men. In the meantime, Squire and Captain Smollett were still on pretty distant terms with one another. The Squire made no bones about the matter. He despised the Captain. The Captain, on his part, never spoke but when he was spoken to, and then sharp and short and dry, and not a word wasted. He owned, when driven into a corner, that he seemed to have been wrong about the crew, and that some of them were as brisk as he wanted to see, and all had behaved fairly well. As for the ship, he had taken a downright fancy to her. She lay a point nearer the wind than a man has a right to expect of his own married wife, sir. But, he would add, all I say is we're not home again, and I don't like this cruise. The squire at this would turn away and march up and down the deck, chin in air. A trifle more of that, man, he would say, and I should explode. We had some heavy weather, which only proved the qualities of the Hispaniola. Every man on board seemed well content, and they must have been hard to please if they had been otherwise, for it is my belief there was never a ship's company so spoiled since Noah put to sea. Double grog was going on the least excuse. There was duff on odd days, as for instance if the squire heard it was any man's birthday. And always a barrel of apples standing broached in the waist, for anyone to help himself that had a fancy. Never knew good to come of it yet, the captain said to Dr. Livesey. Spoil forecastle hands, make devils. That's my belief. But good did come of the apple barrel, as you shall hear, for if it had not been for that, we should have had no note of warning, and might all have perished by the hand of treachery. This is how it all came about. We had run up the trades to get the wind of the island we are after. I'm not allowed to be more plain. And now we were running down for it with a bright lookout, day and night. It was about the last day of our outward voyage, by the largest computation. Sometime that night, or at latest, before noon of the morrow, we should sight the Treasure Island. We were heading south-southwest and had a steady breeze abeam and a quiet sea. The Hispaniola rolled steadily, dipping her bowsprit now and then with a whiff of spray. All was drawing alow and aloft. Everyone was in the bravest spirits, because we were now so near an end of the first part of our adventure. Now, just after sundown, when all my work was over, and I was on my way to my berth, it occurred to me that I should like an apple. I ran on deck. The watch was all forward, looking out for the island. The man at the helm was watching the luff of the sail and whistling away gently to himself. And that was the only sound, except the swish of the sea against the bows and around the sides of the ship. In I got bodily into the apple barrel and found there was scarce an apple left. But sitting down there in the dark, what with the sound of the waters and the rocking movement of the ship, I had either fallen asleep or was on the point of doing so, when a heavy man sat down with rather a clash close by. The barrel shook as he leaned his shoulders against it, and I was just about to jump up when the man began to speak. It was Silver's voice, and before I had heard a dozen words, I would not have shown myself for all the world, but lay there, trembling and listening in the extreme of fear and curiosity. For from these dozen words, I understood that the lives of all the honest men aboard depended on me alone.
That was Chapter 10 of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson and read by Malcolm Grieve. Our next feature is from Anthea Page, and it's an interview with Francine Blake, a photographer who is studying the occurrences of crop circles in Wiltshire. There are also eyewitness accounts of people who have experienced crop circles. These follow on from the interview with Francine.
Francine Blake, can you tell us about corn circles? You're an expert.
It's a big mystery, very big mystery. There are many of them. We've recorded 6,000. They happen all over the world. They happen in England, of course, it's the best known, but there are reports all over the world of crop circle appearing, always near sites that the ancestors of all races considered to be sacred.
What happens when a corn circle is formed?
We don't witness that. Nobody's ever witnessed it. But we think that from the analysis on the plant and the soil that it's a very quick process, in fact, fractions of a second, because the input of energy is so strong that it would burn the whole field if it was kind of lingering, you know. So it happens very rapidly. Doesn't matter the size, it happens almost instantly.
Is there any light associated with this phenomenon?
We do see lights, sometimes little balls of light, other times a flash of light. There is a connection with light. And in the ancient reports, the historical crop circle talk of light as well. There is a connection with light, definitely, yeah.
Can you tell us about the size of some of these? Because they're quite phenomenal, I believe.
They can be 100 foot, 150. We've had one which was a mile long. Overnight, a mile long, 9/10 of a mile, and another one a mile long, so they are large. They can be very, very big, gigantic. Doesn't matter, they happen just as quickly. So all sizes, from very big to quite small, really.
Tell us about the chemical change in the plant.
Those of us who study this phenomenon decided to go about it in a logical and scientific way and started to collect the soil and the plants to be analyzed in laboratories. And what we found is that inside the crop circles, the plants have gone through a process of being heated from the inside, and often it causes cavities and exit of steam that produces holes in the nodes, and it also bends the plant, but it doesn't burn it. Although we have found some scorch mark on the surface sometimes, it doesn't actually catch fire. We know there is an input of heat that happens when the crop circle manifests, but because it's so quick, it doesn't catch fire. And the soil is transformed as well. It becomes more fertile, in actual fact. It shows that it's been hit by an energy which is as powerful as a bolt of lightning, direct bolt of lightning. So it changes its composition. We can find silica in that. We found crystals and all sorts of things. It's quite remarkable, really.
You've actually sampled water.
Well, it is. It's a scientific experiment, you know, and we take the water and look under the microscope, and you can see the pattern imprinted in water. In a similar way to homeopathy, which is what it is. It's an imprint of energy in water through dilution. And you find that in the crop circles, which means that the energy is actually imprinted in the land. It reproduces as a fractal. I don't know if you're familiar with fractal, but a fractal is a concept that in the very small is contained the very big, in the very big is contained the very small. All the different level, you find the same principle or the same shape. Therefore, you know, like we start from a cell and it multiplies and makes a body. Now, if you take one cell, you can clone it and reconstruct the whole body. That's fractal. That means that in every cell you have the whole. And that's what a fractal is. And it shows at every level there is an impact, you know. There is the same. We see the same. So you see the overall design in the smallest. aspect, which is the fractal.
So you've photographed these circles from a plane, so you've actually seen the majesty and the beauty of them. Can you describe some of the fantastical patterns that have occurred?
It's very difficult to do that without seeing a picture. And that's why when I give a lecture, it has to be illustrated, because we cannot imagine. We just cannot imagine just from being told what it is. You know, the design are absolutely extraordinary, the size, the complexity, the variety, the following up as well. You get trains of thought that come through the symbols and so on. It doesn't give justice to the phenomenon to talk without showing pictures, because people cannot imagine what I'm talking about, you know, and that's why I illustrate my lecture. It's all image-based. It is a visual phenomenon.
But some are based on symbols that are familiar to us, like the Star of David.
Yes, indeed. They are. A symbol is like an alphabet. It means something, and therefore you can use symbols to carry thoughts and concept and principle. And it is like an alphabet. We find it difficult because we're not brought up with that. We're brought up with an alphabet. So it's a different type of symbol, although it is also symbolic. So we have many lines of symbols, and they somehow the symbol evolves and changes. So it's an alphabet that we can recognize, we can become familiar with, and then they play with that to deepen the message or to deepen the transmission of knowledge. They are transmissions of knowledge.
Tell us what happens to the animals when these corn circles appear.
Animals are closer to the earth, as our ancestors were, and as our indigenous people now can feel the lines of energy. Most people don't know their lines of energies on the planet, but animals know that, and they follow these lines. When they walk, it's easier for them to walk. And as you know from the tsunami, they sense the tsunami a couple of hours before it happened, and they run away. Animals run away from crop circles. We've had many, many examples. People don't know why they run out of the field, and then they find a few hours later something happens in that field that the animals had sensed, because they sense an agitation in the land. We don't sense that. We've lost that instinct, you know, human beings.
Can you tell our listeners what happened to the porcupine that was found in a field after a corn circle happened?
Yes. There are animals all over there, a sheep in the field, and there are horses, and there are all sorts of wild animals and so on. So the only thing we found that were caught up in that maelstrom when the design happened are porcupine and hedgehogs, which is the same family actually. Porcupines have been found caught up in a crop circle, and they're completely flattened, totally dehydrated, absolutely dead, and their spine follow the flow of the crop. Here we found hedgehogs, not many. It's rare, but you know, when hedgehogs and porcupines sense danger, they stay put and they put their spines up. They don't run away like other animals do. So they are the only animals. We have also found flies dehydrated in crop circle and stuck to the plant with the trunk, the tongue, but completely dehydrated and their wings up as if they were trying to fly off, and they've been completely zapped by that.
Crop circles here in a season, the end of May, June, July, August. The whole August last year, I have seen them. They were just incredible, and some of them, they were super fresh. So only four people appeared, the first four people, and to experience that feeling of that fresh crop circle, and them, it was just incredible feeling of it. It is something unreal, really. There, as you come to the crop circle and you meet people over there, it's a strange feeling of connection between them. There's no separation between us, we are all one. So I feel very uplift, and suddenly as I walk around, I just feel like everything, just the energy, it was so high that I couldn't see it properly, because it was all like, it was very high. It just, I had to sit in one of those places. I realized after that I was there for 2 hours in amazing state, like I was just relaxing, and when I woke up I feel like reborn.
Bit of a life-changing experience, would you say?
Crop circles are for everyone. Everyone can find a little thing for them. It's a different consciousness, really. those symbols, they're like kind of a keywords to something to make us think why they are appearing, why they are like that, and why they are always different and became more complicated, like messages. That's what I feel. I'm just loving them. I really do. And
where was this crop circle?
This crop circle was around Silbury Hill and Alton Barnes.
What was it shaped like?
It was shape of several circles spread in one length, as long as a whole wheat field.
So do you think it's man-made?
No way, no. It's just too big, and probably there will have to be so many people and with the help of helicopter to make it happen, really, because it just looked too perfect in a geometrical. It will involve a lot of people to work on one of them.
Who do you think makes them?
Star beings.
Aliens?
Aliens or some other intelligent beings from the higher dimension.
Well, living in the area, of course, you get to see a lot. Some do seem, it has to be said, to be somewhat man-made, but an awful lot are in such fantastic positions and they're so complex. I came to the conclusion a long time ago that we're interacting with the Earth. We do on an everyday basis, but the crop circles are a clear indication that our thoughts can combine with the energies of the Earth.
The crop circle was just a few hundred yards from where we are standing now in Alton Priors, and it was a swallow formation that came down in two stages, swallows flying towards the east and towards the west. I visited the formation on a beautiful July evening. I had the most amazing sensation. It was such a peaceful and very quiet and very uplifting sensation I had. And when I drove home from there, my husband took a couple of photographs of me in our back garden. And we were very astonished to see that there were these big, luminous, gleaming lights around me, like invisible energy. For a couple of days, I could kind of hear a very, very high-pitched sound and felt very energetic and like a presence. So that lasted a couple of days after I visited the formation. I definitely thought that there's more to crop circles than just a couple of men with a stamping board. There was something mystical and kind of magical and uplifting about the crop circles. And I have had a couple of similar experiences in two other crop circles. There's just something very, very magical and amazing about crop circles, and something I'm looking forward to every summer circle season starts. I can feel the excitement in me and wanting to go and visit some of the formation that speaks to me on a different level.
What do you think causes them? Is it some sort of religious or spiritual energy?
It's very difficult to say, but I definitely believe that when we start to communicate on a different level, then we have some kind of influence on what is going on with crop circles. They're making, maybe even, but of course I don't know. I don't know what crop circles are. I just know that there's something inexplainable. There's something intangible about it, and I can't say anything more than that. I haven't got a clue. I believe nobody really have got a clue where they come from, but there's something very good and something very beautiful and something, I might use the word divine, about them.
Do you think it's got anything to do with your background? Your mother was an Inuit Indian?
I just know when I grew up, I grew up in a home where spirituality was just part of everyday life and just normal. It's hard to say whether it has to do anything with me being maybe in some way a little bit closer in the genes to the earth. I don't know.
Thank you.
The website for the Wiltshire Crop Circle Study Group is www.wccsg.com, or you can ring them on 01380 739 966. There is a Crop Circle conference coming up at the beginning of August at Marlborough College, when you will be able to experience the Crop Circle phenomenon for yourself. Rosemary Dunn, a poet from Bristol, is here in the studio to read us one of her poems.
Hello there. Hi, this poem that I'm going to do is one that I wrote in collaboration with a fellow poet, and I've written a blog about it on my website, which is www.rosemarydunn.co.uk, and that's done with one end. And it was after being really a bit cheesed off waiting for the belly dancers to finish at Ashton Court Festival and for us to get on with running the poetry tent that we got together and wrote this poem. So it's about festivals in general. We are the world. By aspirant bouncing butterflies, I crouched coy as a grub backstage at the One World Festival. I wasn't in their club of housewives with a hobby, belly dancing flounced in silk. Some looked like Mr. Blobby with skin as white as milk. Pot bellies swathed in chiffon, they danced the seven veils. Not one of them was Muslim, but some had come from Wales. We love the Arab traditions, trills Mrs. Pontin Frames. Elsewhere in far-off deserts, vultures peck at shallow graves. The Cotswold samba bands as hot as salsa and tequila, amplified like gunshots on the streets of the favela, as the future of a hunted child forever lies unfurled, his cultures cherry-picked by those who sing, "We are the world." And so I seek asylum in the toilets down the hall from the Anglo-Saxon mummers and their global festival. Their faces stodgy cake mix paste, no dusky maidens here, just flaccid white bread, lemonade, drop scones and ginger beer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Quick plug for workshops, which I'm running at Bristol Folk House on creative writing. And the first one is How to Plot Your Novel. That's on Saturday, the 30th of July. Poetry Workshop on Monday, the 1st of August. And The Writing Gym on Wednesday, the 3rd of August. And that's Bristol Folk House at 40A Park Street. Telephone number 0117 926 2987, website www.bristolfolkhouse.co.uk.
Thank you, Rosemary. Tim Burrows is here in the studio. What do you have for us this week?
Well, I've written a tune called The Memory of a Wave.
Great.
So, yes, that's what I've got.
Tim.
Oh, thanks for having me. Yeah, cheers.
Jess Sparks isn't in the studio today, so Addie is going to read us the What's On Guide. Over to you, Annie.
Hello. This is your What's On guide from Dialet. Starting with Friday, 8th of July, the computers will be performing with support from Radio Nasties at the Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance. On to Saturday, 9th of July, Cable Co will be performing at the Crown, which is at 4 Marketplace, Glastonbury. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is free. On to Song of the Week, and I present Port Isaac's Fisherman's Friends. This group formed in 1995, signed a record deal in 2010, and despite performing around the country at festivals and gigs, they can still be seen performing in Port Isaac during the summer. This is from the album Home from the Sea, and it is a song titled Sitting by the River on the Levee.
Well, I'm sitting by the river on the levee, waiting till the steamer come down. Them cotton bales are looking mighty heavy, 4 miles and miles around. Thought I heard the steamer when she landed on the levee below. Well, I'm sitting by the river on the levee, waiting till the steamer come down. Noah, Noah, that foolish man, built the ark on sandy land.
Who built the ark?
Brother Noah, Noah.
Who built the ark?
Brother Noah, Noah.
Brother Noah built the ark.
Well, I'm sitting by the river on the levee, waiting till the steamer come down. Them cotton bales are looking mighty heavy, 4 miles and miles around. I thought I heard the steamer when she landed on the levee below. Well, I'm sitting by the river on the levee, waiting till steamer come down. Matthew, Martha, Luke, and John, all of them sinners is dead and gone.
Who built the ark?
Brother Noah, Noah.
Who built the ark?
Brother Noah, Noah.
Brother Noah built the ark.
Well, I'm sitting by the river on the levee, waiting till steamer come down. Them cotton bales are looking mighty heavy, 4 miles and miles around. Thought I heard the steamer when she landed on the levee below. Well, I'm sitting by the river on the levee,
waiting till the steamer come down.
Well, Moses standing on the Red Sea shore, smiting that water with a 2x4.
Who built the ark?
Brother Noah, Noah.
Who built the ark?
Brother Noah, Noah.
Brother Noah built the ark.
Well, I'm sitting by the river on the levee, waiting till the steamer come down. Them cotton bales are looking mighty heavy, 4 miles and miles around. Thought I heard the steamer when she landed on the levee below. Well, I'm sitting by the river on the levee, waiting till the steamer come down. Matthew, Mark was sitting in the shade, counting all the money that I ain't made.
Who built the ark?
Brother Noah, Noah.
Who built the ark?
Brother Noah, Noah.
Brother Noah built the ark.
Well, I'm sitting by the river on the levee, waiting till the steamer come down. Them cotton bales are looking mighty heavy, 4 miles and miles around. Thought I heard the steamer when she landed on the levee below. Well, I'm sitting by the river on the levee, waiting till the steamer come down.
That was Port Isaac Fisherman's Friend of Sitting by the River on the Levee from the album Home from the Sea. For more information on them, you can check out www.portisaacsfishermansfriends.com. Staying with Saturday, 9th of July, 60s Motown and Soul Midsummer Bash will be at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Finally, on Sunday, 10th of July, Lee McCoy, Steve Payne and John Pierce will all be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Addie, for the What's On Guide. That's all from Dialect this week. Studio guests were Malcolm Beecham from the Company of Chivalry and Esme Babanietsa Salma, a presenter from Hungarian Radio. Featured was by Anthea Page. Malcolm Grieve read Part 2, Chapter 10 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Poem by Rosemary Dunn. Music from poet and musician Tim Burrows. The presenters were
Alec Mill
and I'm Sophia Costa. The engineer was Michael Noyce and the producer was Anthea Page. Thank you and goodbye.
Set sail for the always islands through seas of leaving to the summer stars. With gaze unchanging, oh deep-eyed sisters, is it you I see? Seeds of beauty ye bear within you. Unborn children, glad and free. Within your fingers, the fates are spinning the sacred binding of the yellow grain. Scattered we were when the long night was breaking, but in bright morn